Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, hello, and welcome, or should I say welcome back, to the Indie Football Podcast. I am Ed Mallion, as ever, and I am flanked by just two this week of my most faithful and trusted servants. To my right, Chief Football Writer of The Independent, looking very confused at the microphone. Don't know why. Miguel Delaney?
Yep, thanks. I noticed some sort of bump in the microphone there.
Just the weird cross-eyed nature of which you're looking at it. Not the most flattering of images on this beautiful Tuesday. But there is a flattering image over there of Jack Pitt-Brook. Hello.
Hi, Ed. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm fine. It was an incredible weekend of football, I guess. You were at the Championship playoff final.
I was, yeah. It was really, really good.
Great game, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was one of those Championship games where, like, there was just enough quality for it to be good. Like, Fulham are a really good... I mean, they are like a recognisable Premier League team. Like, they play really, really good stuff. And Villa don't play really good stuff, but they did have the best player in Jack Grealish. And it was even, it was really tense. Fulham were incredible in the first half. Second half was all about Grealish. Fulham just about hung on with 10 men. Sometimes those games are rubbish. Like Huddersfield Reading last year was awful. It was so bad. Yeah. But this was really good.
What do you think of the refereeing, by the way?
Liberal.
Yeah, I thought the ref was a bit soft.
Like Fulham were kicking holes out of Grealish all game. Ryan Fredericks should have been sent off for stamping on him early on. Then they did lots of tactical fouling. Dennis Odoi kicked him up in the air twice and was eventually sent off. That is something that Fulham will have to address next year in the Premier League because you don't get away with those tackles quite so much. But that said, I thought Fulham absolutely deserved to go up from being so good all season. Like it's certainly odd. I mean, it will look odd next year that it was Fulham that came third and Cardiff that came second because Cardiff are going to get like 15 points. whereas Fulham, I think, if they buy well, should fit quite naturally into the Premier League.
And buying well has been a key part of them getting where they are. Like last year, I thought they were, last season, they were the best footballing team in the league. This year, undoubtedly, I think the best footballing team in the league, whatever Wolves fans might say. Fulham have been outstanding with the ball, especially since January. They got those key signings in January, which were Cyrus Christie, Matt Target, and of course Alexander Mitrovic.
Yeah, I've spoken to Jokanović a few times about this, and he always points the January transfer window as being the hinge moment in their season. I've spoken to people at Fulham, and they say that they could tell how much more kind of invigorated and relaxed he was when he got the players he wanted, because obviously recruitment has been a big issue at Fulham. Over quite a few years now. Mitrovic gave them that kind of nasty edge which they lacked because they didn't really have a proper centre forward before. Whereas Mitrovic, I mean, he's probably not fit enough for the Premier League or hasn't been under Rafa, but in the Championship where you don't have to be quite as quick, and his elbows are given a little bit more freedom to do their thing.
Yeah.
He's been incredibly effective. He's scored some great goals. He was very good. And such a handful again on Saturday. Target's been pretty solid at left back, and Christie at right back. So, yeah, it was a fantastic window for them.
I saw them in the FA Cup earlier this season against Southampton when Pellegrino was under pressure, and basically Fulham were a really good footballing team. They didn't have Mitrovic that day, and it was exactly that. They almost were playing too nice football. There was no one with an edge. They brought him in, and it's as well as the work rate and actual, you know, technical footballing bit, he is still quite good. You know, he has scored a lot of goals, 12 goals, I think, since he signed, which is exactly what you want from a January signing. But I looked at the teams, I think I was talking to you during the game about this, and the Villa team looked like kind of a lower Premier League, upper Championship 11 almost. It was like, almost like Premier League years 2013-14.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like the back four.
Yeah, Knack, Snodgrass, Hutton, yeah, JT, Chesters.
Back four was James Chester, John Terry, Alan Hutton, Ahmed El-Mohammedi. The midfield was like, again, as you say, like all Premier League cast-offs, for want of a better word. And Fulham, their 11, despite me knowing that they're a much better footballing team, having watched them this season, their 11 was weaker, but they had probably the three or four really good quality players, and two of the three best players, in the entire league this year, apart from Ruben Neves, in Tom Kenny and in Ryan Sessegnon, and they ultimately combined for the goal.
Yeah, Kenny's a great player to watch. He's probably someone who, you know, will be slightly under the radar of some people who don't watch the Championship, like Miguel. But he's...
Miguel would have enjoyed Tom Kenny after the game. They asked him, you know, like, how does it feel to be the winner? Football is the winner. because, you know,
we actually just in Kiev just before the Champions League final that morning, we played a match against Ukrainian media who had a former international team, and they absolutely battered us because they were all, you know, powerhouses, whereas we were out, you know, enjoying Kiev the night before, etc. But at the end of it, it was so well organised. They had kind of a PA, and he goes to the end. Apologies for the bad accent, but it was basically and Ukraine media wins 7-2, but really friendship won.
Very nice.
Would you say that Ukrainian 11 benefited from Ukraine's kind of liberal approach to certain aspects of regulating sports nutrition?
Well, they were. I mean, put it this way: the only player on their team that wasn't a physical powerhouse was former international centre half Vladimir Vaschuk. And he was the only one that was slightly overweight, and yet, of course, is recently retired. But yeah, they were.
Okay, name names. Who are the best and worst players on the UK media team?
I'd say Johnny Northcroft and Max Rushton.
Is Northcroft really good? Isn't
best. Yeah, Northcroft brilliant under half.
And worst?
I had an awful day. The first day, well, to be honest, I hadn't slept much. And
why didn't you sleep much?
The kickoff was at 11 a.m., which first of all is ridiculous, and secondly, we were. We had a late dinner the previous night.
Oh, late dinner. Okay, yeah. Fair enough. No, I don't know when they eat. I don't know when they eat in Ukraine.
Was it hot?
Yeah, it was about, I'd say, 25 degrees.
At 11 a.m.?
Yeah. Oh.
Brutal.
I must admit, a friend of ours who writes for another newspaper, I saw him yesterday, and he said he made some disparaging comments about some of my independent colleagues. So and their performances in that game. So it's very noble of you to put your hand up and admit that it was you.
No, I have to... you know, team player.
This is like the equivalent of going to the mix zone after you've lost and fronting up and saying, yeah, we're men, we can take it on the chin.
Yeah, you know, stadium drop, played at Old Trafford on the previous Tuesday. And at this point in my life, and having got used to playing five-a-side all the time, A, I'm not used to playing 11-a-side anymore, and B, 11-a-side is knackering. Like, it's militarily sticking to a position and just running up and down at that level.
Well, I sent you the videos of, or the clips of us playing at Selhurst Park the week before, which are... a pedestrian, to say the least. The amateur fitness really gets shown up and it makes you wonder how on earth they counter at such pace. When like we could barely get it to the halfway line in the time that Wilfried Zaha has already done 50 yards and scored. But it does make you remember. Any other final thoughts on the Championship playoff final, Jack, before we leave that behind? Just looking forward to seeing Fulham, I think.
Yeah, I think Fulham are going to be, if as long as they recruit well, which I'm sure they will. And I think the big story is they'll probably keep Sessegnon. Like, if they hadn't won, then Sessegnon would probably have been sold for 40, 50 million.
Well, they'll keep a few players. Ryan Fredericks is one that a lot of clubs are looking at. Hodgson is there.
United, you know, it's been well reported that United are very keen, City very keen. I mean, I was told recently that City have watched Ryan Sessegnon 50 times.
He'd be unbelievable as a left back under Guardiola.
Yeah. Tottenham obviously made a move for him last year, and if they were to lose Danny Rose, then he'd be a very plausible kind of guy to alternate with Ben Davis. But I think we can park all that for another year or two because I'm sure he'll stay on improved terms in the Premier League.
You know, they've got decent money with Shad Khan backing them. It's great for him, for his investment, I guess, that they're back in the league. The one I'm most happy for is Slavisa Jokanovic, who obviously got Watford promoted a few years ago and never got to manage a Premier League game. He's done things the right way at Fulham and he's been rewarded. And I think now he'll be rewarded with a stint in the Premier League, which is great. But after that game was all over, after we dusted that all off, we did go to Kiev, where Miguel and three other of the Indy's finest were in Kiev for Liverpool versus Real Madrid. A game which might go down as one of the great Champions League finals in terms of the amount of stories that came out the other end of it. I can't remember a single final which has so much kind of roll-on effect.
Yeah. Yeah, I was actually thinking about this on my way back. It was probably a bit like a kind of condensed Italia 90 in the sense that the football actually wasn't that good. And it was mostly dull. And yet, despite being dull for a lot of the game, when it actually was entertaining, it was beyond entertaining. It was kind of there was so much out of it. It probably was an inferior game to the championship match, actually. But just, I mean,
How does it compare? I mean, you've been to what, 10 Champions League finals in a row?
Yeah.
Is that right? How does this? I mean, can you compare it to any others, or would you say it stands out in any way?
You didn't do Istanbul, did you?
No, the first one I did was Barca United in 2009 in Rome.
What was the 2010 final? And the only reason I ask this is because one of the reasons there's rollout to from this game is the fact that we have the World Cup coming up.
Yeah.
Salah's injury would be significant, but would not be anything like as significant if there wasn't a World Cup coming up in a few weeks' time, of which he is obviously going to be one of the biggest stars and kind of a shining light of a more minor national team, a less celebrated national team, perhaps, although won a lot of continental titles. So before 2010, what were the big stories coming out of that Champions League final?
Mourinho going to Real Madrid.
Of course.
Yeah, that was probably the biggest, the way he left Inter. It was a bit odd in that one. There wasn't too much World Cup stuff out of it.
That was the summer that United tried to sign Schneider for the first time, right?
Yeah, but that was more after the World Cup, I think.
Okay.
Melito was on form, actually. But even still, like...
What about 2014? Remember anything like that?
2014, that was Lisbon. That was Real beating Atletico
4-1. So again, it's not. Why this is so interesting, right? Because so what have we got coming out of it? I guess, is there anything you want to say about the actual flow of the match itself?
Liverpool
were the better side before Salah got injured.
Yeah, but it wasn't just the way the game changed. It was how deeply it changed. I mean, you could just feel it around the stadium. Like everything transformed once that injury happened. Liverpool seemed like they lost belief, although I think they deserve a bit of credit for getting a goal so quickly after the first Real Madrid goal or Carius Howler.
I think I wrote on the night that the problem was they didn't put together much fluid attacking play essentially after Salah went off, and the numbers bore that out, you know, the touches in the attacking third, etc. So what you need when you're in that zone, when you're really in trouble and struggling to string it together, what you need is a set piece goal.
Yeah.
They got the set piece goal, but at no point did they really look like capitalising on that goal they'd kind of been gifted.
I mean, my overriding impression was that Liverpool kind of overstretched themselves to get that far. Even, I suppose it's a kind of like a Klopp characteristic, but it just felt once Salah went on, they were just stretched too far. And it was such a kind of a struggle for them to kind of get anywhere really. Mane was actually quite impressive.
He's a good player. You know, he can be frustrating, obviously. Yeah. I think that's the thing with him is obviously he's incredibly fast and makes some very good runs, takes some great angles. But he's never had the consistent production that Salah has this season. I thought he was their biggest threat.
Completely.
To be honest. Lallana replacing Salah, unfortunately, didn't really bring much to the table, did he?
Klopp was trying, but like, kind of just removed. It didn't remove. It was removed when Salah went off, but Liverpool had no zip about them.
Firmino had a very disappointing game, I thought.
Yeah. Although, I mean, there's probably kind of an argument there. That's kind of...
It's difficult.
One of the ways in which Klopp has made... Liverpool players kind of benefit from more than some of their parts, and that Firmino is better when he has a front line of Mane and Salah offering such pace because it brings out the best in him as well. And once one of those goes, he doesn't have the same areas to move into. People can't play off him.
He's obviously a great finisher and stuff, but he's a link-up guy.
Yeah.
Who drops in deep and the two others go ahead of him. So he's never like usually the tip of that front three. He kind of drops in to a deeper role. And you're basically sandwiched between Sergio Ramos, Varane, and Casemiro in that role. And I think they did quite well as a triangle to kind of shut him out of the game. Whether that was by Zidane's design or just coincidence. It's one of those things that Zidane never gets really attributed, these little tactical things. And he's even said himself, I'm not a very tactical coach. But, you know, these things don't necessarily happen by accident.
Beyond that, again, Real were just... I know how many times we said this, but it's true. They were so unconvincing again.
Johnny said, obviously, the last podcast we had, Johnny said, this is so boring. And we always talk about Real Madrid and basically they're not very impressive.
Yeah.
And they still managed to win everything.
But it was in Madrid and microcosm, basically. Not a great performance. And then an individual piece of brilliance from a player they've bought for a world record fee or for a sensational fee.
It was a world record fee at the time. It was one that they denied was, and it came out at Football League said it was, of course, as we knew.
But won by that. And that was the real winning moment. I mean, I suppose that was what felt so harsh on Karius as well. His second howler, at that point, even felt unnecessary. Like, the game was kind of, Liverpool didn't look like they were going to do anything. Like, it looked done.
Jack, what do you make of Bale's goal? What was your instant reaction?
Well, I got hammered for this on Twitter, but I thought that Ronaldo's against Juventus was better. Not just because I was there, and I want to make things all about me, but because, I don't know, I just kind of felt like, I felt that Ronaldo's against Juventus was more precise and more controlled.
Yeah.
I think with Bale's, there's an element of kind of like, I was going to say hit and hope. It's more like jump and hit and hope. But there was an element of it was a kind of brilliantly instinctive, like, swing.
Yeah.
Whereas Ronaldo's is like a textbook piece of technique.
Yeah.
Miguel, my question is always, when there's a 1-0 goal at the stadium, did you see it?
Yep.
You actually watched it live?
I actually just been to the restroom and sat down just as Bale was making contact with it with the ball.
I've missed so many good goals that way. But great to see it live. Like, incredibly impressive just watching it as it occurs.
The only thing, beyond the context, I suppose, which is the fact it's a match win in the final, the one way I would say it's superior to Ronaldo's, or one element of it that's superior to Ronaldo's, I thought the trajectory of the ball was better. Right, so Ronaldo's kind of went low into the corner.
You do have your favourite trajectory.
I agree with that, but I would say how much is that down to design?
I know what you mean.
It's just like... Yeah. The kind of fluky physics of contact.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the latter, but I think it just...
Because I thought my case for Ronaldo's is in part because I think Ronaldo's was a cleaner contact.
Yeah.
And it went... I think that, like, with any goal like this, the more control and the less randomness, the better. And I thought there was more control to Ronaldo's and more randomness to Bale's.
I'd agree with that,
And fundamentally, the Bale goal... It's huge because obviously it wins them the game. I think
his second match-winning goal in that way.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
The second Champions League final where he's made it from 1-1 to 2-1 in a victory. Well, where he's either a goal.
Yeah. You know, we've covered his 5-year now stay at Real Madrid, which is quite incredible. It feels like yesterday that he went out there. You know, we've covered the whole thing, and he's had a lot of downtime. He's had a lot of bad spells where he's injured and whatever. But when he's had good times at Real Madrid, it's been incredible.
It's amazing that you can say, like, you know, had a mixed time at Real Madrid. I mean, on the one hand, he's won the Champions League 4 times.
Yeah,
but on the other hand...
That Copa del Rey winning goal, the one in the final against Barcelona, where he literally was like 10 yards off the pitch, sprints around, and then brings it in, does Pinto at the near post, wins them the Copa del Rey. You know, against Atletico in the Champions League final to win the Champions League for them. He's won numerous Champions League finals. Like, the most disappointing one for him was probably the one that emotionally was the best, the Cardiff one, where he basically played very little part in the Cardiff final, but they won it in his hometown, which is great for him.
Yeah.
And then this one, where he has the huge influence, like, not many of his family. He had a couple of friends there who flew over from Wales, but it's in Kiev. It doesn't mean anything to him in that respect. But then a huge moment for him. And then what he says after the game.
Yeah.
You know, and my question for you is, to come out with that straight after a game when you should be delighted with winning and stuff, did that have an essence of premeditation to you?
Maybe. I think it's more forgivable in Bale's case because he was going to be asked anyway, whereas with Ronaldo, like...
It's entirely forgivable.
Yeah. And like, there was a context, but I know it was an obvious question, whereas Ronaldo kind of dropped it out of nowhere and I was like, oh God. And that seems to be the case in the reaction.
Well, Ronaldo's has backfired tremendously, whereas Bale's has been accepted by the Madrid press, who realised that, you know, he isn't going to start every week at Madrid. And going forward, their plan would involve more of Asensio and players like that, and potentially Neymar or Mbappe, rather than Bale. So they understand it. Bale has done himself, obviously, a huge amount of favours. We wrote in February that he'd be leaving Real Madrid this summer anyway, something which was summarily denied by his agent, of course, but, you know, that wasn't true. And now it's coming towards the summer. He said this. I wrote in that piece in February that, you know, they'd want 100 million for him, but they had no hope of getting that because no one is going to pay 100 million for a 29-year-old who's had injury problems, who's, you know, as good as he is at lots of things. One of his great assets is explosiveness and speed and acceleration and strength, which comes, you know, as a thing which you lose over time.
Yeah.
It is just one of those, it's part and parcel of having that attribute, is that you know that that's not something you keep forever. And Bale could transform himself like Cristiano Ronaldo into a centre forward or someone who plays closer to goal. I think he might have to.
Yeah.
But what price would you expect Bale to fetch now in the open market? And how different is it to what pre that goal he would have got?
It probably does change things a lot, because to have maybe the fact he wasn't in the Madrid team, and one of those reasons being injury, lent itself to a perspective that he's in decline, maybe faster than he should be at his age. But whereas the goal was kind of an immediate riposte to that, and people say, well, it's him. He can't get much better reading the club game, a match winning performance in the Champions League final. Actually, as a slight tangent, his performances in Champions League finals are actually probably better than Ronaldo's.
Yeah, I mean, Ronaldo's not really... I mean, it's hard to pinpoint too many big Champions League final moments for Ronaldo at Real Madrid.
Yeah, but I think 2017 was by far his best final when he was the match winner at the time. Because look, 2008, okay, got the first goal. Then Chelsea equalised. He was kind of quiet after that, then missed the penalty. 2009, he had a nightmare, although that was basically because Barca wouldn't let United have the ball. 2014, he wasn't fully fit in his home and kind of did nothing until
the kind of penalty.
Yeah, they kind of just the.
That was a moment. That pen, like looking back, that penalty was such a moment of people realizing, hold on a second, it's all about him. He doesn't really care about the Real Madrid, does he?
This is we actually had a discussion after the game. Some of it should never be made public, but what Ronaldo would say to ensure he's the story if the situation ever right where he hasn't had a good game in a big match.
Tell us what your conclusion was.
Do you think that Ronaldo made those comments about his future in the aftermath of the Kiev final so that he would be the headline the next day, having not made himself the headline on the pitch?
It's difficult to pass, because even those odd comments about kind of they should rename it the CR7 trophy or everything,
are those real?
Well, actually, that's a good question.
I saw them. I mean, they were so insane. I thought even for Ronaldo.
Do we know if they're real? Do we?
What?
The Ronaldo's comments that basically we should rename it the CR7 trophy.
Mate, I was so busy. I was so busy after the final. Everything's going on.
Yeah.
I didn't pay attention to stuff like that. I think the Ronaldo comments actually, people aren't surprised anymore. You know, he's done this so many times. It's every 12 to 18 months. It's a cycle. You can predict exactly how it goes. And this one, the fact that he backtracked on this one so quickly, I think someone, whoever's advising him more closely now, it might not be who people think it is, whoever's advising him most closely now has had a word in his ear and said, look, this has not gone down well. Mm. This has not gone down well. Amazingly, El Chiringuito, who some people will know as that it's supposedly the most popular nightly sports TV show in Spain, and it's shown at about midnight every night, and it's incredibly Real Madrid like biased, like to an absurd extent, in which you would never see in most media markets. I can't think of any countries which are that partisan towards one club, but you know, this show is like a Real Madrid infomercial, and they still spun it as like Ronaldo hadn't done much wrong, which shows you know where their bread's buttered, really. And it was saying that, you know, like Ronaldo has given so much to Madrid that, you know, all he can do is say his own mind. You know, like there's nothing more Madrid than being an honest champion.
This is the odd thing about Ronaldo. I mean, as you mentioned, so much success in Madrid, and so much of it has been kind of undercut by this surliness or him. Like how often has he had a contractual situation or where there's been some kind of demeanor where, like some sort
but
of.
The thing is, it never is a contractual situation. It's the current contract. If what this whole thing was a play for a new contract now. A year ago, Real Madrid signed one of the worst football contracts I've ever seen to Ronaldo, because he just won them another European Cup. But fundamentally, I don't care if Neymar or Messi or whatever are getting paid more. Mm. Ronaldo's 33.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're paying him on a 4 or 5 year deal. Enormous money, and by the end of that contract you know that he won't be playing up to an ability that merits that cash, so they're paying him basically for what he's done in the past. They're paying him extra for what he's done in the past, which I think is fine, and I think you can justify that, especially if you're a club of Real Madrid's means who get away with a lot of stuff. But the fact is that it was a bad contract last year. If you're really trying to bleed more money out of Real Madrid this summer, then you better have done something bloody extraordinary. And the fact is, they've won one trophy this season. It was the Champions League, and he did very little in the final to even merit.
When I look at Ronaldo at Real, I kind of get the impression that he's like too big to sell.
Yeah,
like selling him would be too would be. It's just quite hard.
I feel like
to
last
move,
year was their last chance.
Right,
to sell
it's quite
him, really.
Hard to move someone of that size. And I was wondering whether, I mean, the situations are not the same, but whether you think Bale might be in a slightly similar position in the sense that he's paid so much and his value is so much and his commercial profile is so big that actually finding a buyer who's willing to take all this upon them is difficult.
Well, that's what the piece from February, which I'm sure, like, you know, Miguel will have some thoughts on as well. The piece from February was you can't find a buyer for Bale at his current, yeah, one, transfer price, and two, salary expectations.
Yeah.
The only potential buyer for him on those levels are Manchester United, unless, I guess, Chelsea really, yeah, get involved.
It's actually, it's again another problem with the economic stratification of the game, which on one level, the players obviously reap the rewards of all this. But like we were talking last week about managers, in which Conte can't say go to a Valencia anymore because it's too low down the rung for, mm-hmm, manager standing. Mm-hmm. It's the same with players now. They get themselves into a situation where there's only kind of seven or eight clubs they can go to.
And that's why there was the flirtation with Bayern Munich, where suddenly Gareth Bale's doing an exclusive interview with Bild in the spring, because I think there was some hope that they could kind of convince Bayern to come on board. Yeah. Now that Bayern have outright said in public they're not interested, you know, he's got to look back to the Premier League and say, where am I going to go? Mm. Your point on Ronaldo, Jack, I think, you know, PSG had this infatuation with Cristiano Ronaldo all along since the Qataris got involved. And then last summer, they, you know, it's like, oh, Ronaldo might leave, what are we going to do? Real Madrid give him a contract, PSG go and get Neymar. The infatuation with Ronaldo is now gone. You know, previously, the only club they could really sell him to was PSG because they're the only ones who had all this cash and needed that, how would you say, like it's like a watershed signing.
Yeah,
they've gone and got someone much better and much younger as their watershed signing instead. So now they do have to sell to the Premier League with Bale. With Ronaldo, I guess, I mean, would you put it past Ed Woodward to...
I mean, have him sign Sanchez. I think United will be able to spend big this summer, but they already plan. I couldn't see them going that extra.
If they sold Martial, you could see perhaps buying Bale, but you're making the squad like, what, 7 years older?
Well, he wants Willian as well. So
how likely do you think Bale to United is?
30%, maybe less.
And so what's the other 70% look like? Staying at Real Madrid, quite likely.
I mean, someone said it to me the weekend, basically. Perez loves Bale, so it could just be a case, you know, Jonathan Barnett and Bale sit down with Perez. You know, what's the situation? Perez has got a Zidane. Bale plays, and that's that.
That's
Perez
how Real Madrid works.
Perez have that much sway over Zidane, despite everything?
Yes. I mean, unlike say Benitez, Zidane's, well, previously before he won the Champions League, his status bought him extra decisions that someone like Benitez couldn't. And obviously winning the Champions League has a bit more, but Perez can still, you know, dictate.
I get the impression from people I've talked to who are a bit closer to it than I am now, that Zidane doesn't think there's a huge difference with the players he throws onto the field.
Mm.
That kind of it's more about the atmosphere that he creates around the squad and the aura almost, and... You know, like he'll have key players on and players that he thinks are better matchups. But fun, but it's not a huge difference for him if Bale or Asensio plays.
People who know Bale well think that they think that Zidane isn't that much of a fan of him.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I can see why. The biggest thing is, you know, and Zidane doesn't say much in press conferences, but when he says little things, you have to read what he actually means. And it's the translation is like, we can't count on him. We can't count on him.
Yeah.
We can't count on him. And the point is that despite what he said after the game, oh, I've been fit for most of the season. It's like, how can they rely on you to be fit for most of the season when previously you said you're fit? they brought you back ahead of schedule for the Clásico or whatever, and you go off injured after 13 minutes. That's happened too many times, basically, and it's the recurrent problems in the same areas of his body.
Yeah.
And when it's a player at that age, as I say, and you can't rely on him, why wouldn't you move on to someone like Asensio and be like, my God, this kid's incredible.
Yeah.
Like, he should be our first choice. And if Bale's fit, fine, we can use him as a sub or as a guy we rotate into the system. But it's not a guy you can ever rely on, I think, is what the Real Madrid decision is. And it might not be that case. Like, if he came back and, say, went to Tottenham or someone where he would be playing every week,
yeah,
great. If you can prove that you can play every week, that's terrific.
Do we think Tottenham's a non-starter?
You guys would know better than I would. What do you think?
No way he fits into the wage.
I just don't understand how he fits into the wage structure. It's just impossible. Unless you had...
They are keeping an eye on the situation, I've heard.
Well, they have the first refusal still written into the Real Madrid transfer. But the only way I could see them like breaking their wage structure to afford him, which I'm sure Harry Kane's agent and Dele Alli's agent would adore, by the way, that concept, is you need a sponsor on board, basically, to pay part of the wages at least. And Bale is an Adidas player.
Well, so some people were our closest Spurs were talking to me yesterday about this and saying, now, I suppose some of this gets into quite speculative discussion, but I think his Adidas contract could be coming to an end this summer, and there's talk, if he goes to Nike, that could be usually indicative, because apparently Nike's plan for when Spurs move to the new back to White Hart Lane will be the homecoming, which would obviously tie in very nicely. Again, this is people kind of who have heard little bits of things, you know, potentially putting two and two together. And
the thing is that, you know, I know someone who was quite high up in a sportswear company, and I've asked him things about this before, and it was to do with the last time I really dug in on it was when Man United moved to Adidas. Because he'd said to me that he was like, I guarantee you they'll bring in a massive Adidas category A player. And then someone like Pogba turns up, and you look at the what we'd call the brand activation that they did with him. You know, the Stormzy stuff. That was Pogba, wasn't it?
Was it 2014 they went Adidas? Yeah, it was.
I can't remember what year.
It was Louis van Gaal.
But the point is that a transfer like that means so much more for a club if it's the right player, brand, and everything tied in. You know, if it's Spurs, Nike, the homecoming, and Bale is still an Adidas player, then Nike won't get any value out of that signing, basically. They can't market the guy. So it's not necessarily the way that people want to think about transfers, but it does, I'm told, influence thinking at some level and board level, which is, I guess, the level that matters. Beyond Bale and Ronaldo, Salah's injury... the Egyptian FA sounds like they think he'll get there. He thinks he'll get there.
An Egyptian journalist told me yesterday, 2 to 3 weeks.
I mean, fundamentally, it would be really sad if he didn't make it, because Egypt, you know, despite winning the AFCON pretty much every time during his lifetime, they haven't been in World Cups. How much would you be looking forward to a potential Egypt versus Spain second round game, Jack, if they come
second? Yeah, so we were looking at this earlier. So basically, Egypt are in Group A, Spain are in Group B.
It's a very weak group.
You'd have to say that Spain are probably favourites to win Group B, but you could certainly see Egypt coming second in Group A, probably behind Uruguay, in which case they would meet in the last 16, on the 1st of July at the Luzhniki.
Oh, great.
Which would be amazing for the prospect of either or even both of like Hegazi and the big Egyptian lads kicking holes into Ramos. And then Ramos dislocating Salah's other shoulder. I'm not saying we all want to see Salah injured, but we do all want to see the prospect of that match because of that rivalry.
We had a very pro Sergio Ramos podcast last week. Where are we standing it now?
I resile from nothing that I said about Ramos. Look, the thing is, like, so I mean, I wasn't there. I was watching this on telly. But obviously what he did, okay, my interpretation of it is that I think there was a degree of intent. Like, I think that he obviously, it wasn't a complete accident, and he did mean to discomfort Salah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Leave one in.
Right. Did he mean to dislocate his shoulder? Almost certainly not, just because it's a quite hard thing to do on purpose.
Probably difficult and specific.
Yeah. And I do think that the reaction, the kind of anti-Ramos reaction on Twitter has been a bit much.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's been notable that, like, of all the... I've barely seen any ex-pros or footballers, except those kind of associated with Liverpool.
John Aldridge have a go at him.
Yeah, come out against Ramos. I think there's been a lot of, like, yeah, like, he's a bit of a shithouse. Yeah. This is what he does. But it's kind of in the game.
But even for Liverpool, okay, yeah, fair enough. And it absolutely... The situation did... It was the key moment in the match. It decided the match. Or made it definitive almost that Real Madrid would win. But, I mean, this Liverpool can't complain about that too much when three of their four European Cups involved Graham Souness, and they so openly chuckle about stories about, oh, Souness going to Bucharest and breaking people's jaws. Like, you know, you can't have both ways.
Yeah, and...
Does it change how you feel about Ramos?
No.
If Virgil van Dijk had done Ronaldo in the 23rd minute, their reaction would have been
banners of him already. Yeah.
Mm. You know, there would be like the lionizing of Van Dijk and then like how he,
Big
yeah, yeah, how he did Ronaldo. It's something that happens in football. I don't think for a second Ramos's biggest fear was Salah getting up and leaving him for dead.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he would have done if he could get 2 feet on the ground, he's going and he's going to beat you.
Yeah.
So that's Ramos's biggest fear, because Ramos knows, as we talked about literally last week, he can get beaten in behind,
yeah.
and certainly by someone as fast as Salah, and it's happened numerous times when they played against each other, Roma, Real Madrid. So fundamentally, Ramos has accidentally injured the guy. And it has changed the game. You're right. But that doesn't mean necessarily there has to be some sort of like severe repercussions for Ramos. I think it's a bizarre... I mean, I get it. It hurts. It probably hurts a lot because Salah basically propelled them to near greatness.
Yeah.
And it makes you wonder what could have been. It really does.
That's what it comes down
to. Because if he played that entire final, and I've got to say, before he went off, they were genuinely the better team.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow. Like you do have a feeling like, they could have done something special there, and Sergio Ramos has stopped that. But he's not done it in a way that I think it is some sort of like criminal act in the way it's been portrayed.
It's not like he's gone up to him off the ball and punched him in the face.
No, that was Loris Karius.
It's like within the remit of things that happen on the football
exactly.
field.
Yeah, exactly. It's the flow of the game. Yeah. Even if it's distorting that flow slightly, it's still it's a natural carry on.
By the way, Karius, we should talk about.
Before we get to that, one thing about Salah, even from a neutral point of view, when that sort of thing happens, you also feel a bit robbed, because it's like we haven't got to see a game like that played on its best possible terms, because
it would have been. Yeah, I mean, obviously, it would have been a far better game.
Yeah,
with Salah on the pitch.
Yeah, but your poor. I mean, Karius.
Well, Johnny, literally last Monday wanted to write this piece about how Karius was the most average goalkeeper to ever play in a Champions League final, and I kind of talked him out of it into doing something else, and then
on Salah,
it would have been perfect if he had written that, because Karius is, you know, he's always been one for the future, and basically the reason to go with him ahead of Mignolet when they're both error prone throughout this season was Karius is the younger one who we might keep for the future, whereas Mignolet, realistically, sorry pal, you're done. You've had so many chances, you're done. So Karius has never looked the confident guy that you wanted him to be, perhaps, and he's never looked like the guy, but he's done enough, and they've got to the Champions League final, and then this happens. And how do you explain it? Can you explain it, Jack? Or is it just you have to get over it and move on, and you probably have to buy a new keeper this summer, if not two?
Yeah, I mean, well, it certainly doesn't... It's weird, isn't it? Because people say, like, he did it because he's not good enough, but the mistakes were not the mistakes of a keeper that isn't good enough, were they? They're not like he was slow getting down or he... slightly miscalculated distance. They're like, the mistakes are so catastrophic that they are far removed from like the fine margins of being good enough or not being good enough as a goalkeeper.
The first one was one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen happen. It just shouldn't happen at a game, let alone a Champions League final.
Yeah.
Just like any sort of kind of top level match.
You would mercilessly shred anyone who that happened to in your five-a-side team.
Yeah. Actually, one of the interesting things in that sense, there's been a lot of talk after the game about how people at Liverpool, actually the players and staff, reacted, and that not enough went up to Karius afterwards, etc., etc. Now, I think some eventually did, But I do wonder, like, I've heard stories from former pros that, you know, in a dressing room after a defeat, they made a mistake. So some pros come up to them and you fucking cost me my win bonus, you prick. Like, and it's harsh like that. And you do wonder whether some players, and not say the Liverpool players did, but whether some are thinking, I've had a chance at history here and he's blown it for me.
Older players, I think. It's a bigger issue with older players. I've heard it in a context of different sports, actually, where an older player lost a World Cup final, went over to one of the younger players who was perceived to have underperformed, said, I'll never get this chance back because of people like you. And it's like, well, I mean, it's strong. It's strong.
Rugby or cricket?
Cricket, yeah. And it's brutal. But it's like, that's how they feel in the heat at the moment. Like, they're a super competitive person. And like, yeah, like you wouldn't want to go over. Like, I mean, Karius was inconsolable, right? You don't want to go over to the crying German kid who's like 24 and you're 35 years old. Well, so you're James Milner. Like, you know, James Milner, I don't think is ever going to be the guy to do that.
Yeah.
But like, for James Milner, this was like probably career pinnacle.
Yeah.
You know, like, I know he's won the Premier League. But he's in the Champions League final and he's thinking, look, if Salah can do his job here and we defend, I know we can defend, we can win a Champions League, which would be enormous, you know, for a player like him. And he's not going to now.
Yeah.
You know, and he might never get there again. The chances are he will never get there again. So I could see that frustration. I'd understand that frustration. I think it's just one of those things where, like, you are now consigned to being that guy, if you're Karius. You are, like, it's doing a Karius.
It's a career-defining
moment. Right, yeah. Like, it's kind of inconceivable that he will ever do anything to... You can't, like, counterbalance.
That,
you can't counterbalance that.
I guess
you're going to do
in August, September, there's going to be a big soft interview with him.
4 years' time, he's going to go to the World Cup final and save 5 pence, and Germany win. It's not going to happen. Yeah. Like, it's not least because he won't get the chance to. Because you wouldn't trust him in a game that big.
Has any player had that level of redemption? Stuart Pearce, maybe, but like missing a penalty.
I can't think of any player. Well, the thing is, I can't think of. Not only can I not think of any player who has, like, gone through like a positive equivalent to that negative.
Yeah.
I can't think of any player who's gone through that negative. Like, I can't think of any player who's made two mistakes that bad in a game of that size.
He's lucky the other Bale goal was good.
Yeah.
Because if there hadn't been the
thunder
strike as the second, if they'd lost courtesy of two terrible, terrible mistakes, it's so much worse.
Well, this actually, one thing he can maybe console himself, actually, not that he'd probably think along these terms, his errors actually didn't cost him the game. Because the first one was cancelled out. The first cancelled out, and the second was kind of.
Podcast listeners, I'm screwing up my face in disbelief.
but it didn't.
It didn't help.
But you know what I mean?
I'd say, like, going 1-0 down in the Champions League final was probably quite an effective way of putting
it's
on the back
foot. It's a bold attempt at a pro Karius take.
Yeah, I appreciate the attempt at a pro Karius take. I just don't think there's any room for one at the moment.
The big question is, do you think they'll sign a new number one?
You have to.
Do you think he's now, like, unselectable?
No, I think he becomes the cup goalkeeper for next year. And then a year on. I actually think it's almost too cruel to sell him this summer. I think...
Although he needs
him the number two, make him the cup keeper,
build
his confidence back up, and then sell him off next year.
Yeah, it's just...
if I was saying...
I don't want to make a joke out of it, but every time I just think about the whole situation, it's just...
If I was shocked,
it makes me really sad. Like, it's just a really sad situation. He's always going to be that guy.
Yeah.
And he'll always be... Like, you can't escape from this kind of stuff.
So did you see Cy Yu's piece for us today? In which, and Cy starts his piece detailing the reaction in the crowd of...
Karius' girlfriend and mother.
Yeah, his mother, his girlfriend. And then how Klopp's wife actually came down to them because she saw how distraught they were. And they're kind of, fucking, like, the humanity
it's
of that.
It's brutal, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I saw some people saying, like, oh, well, if you did that in any other job, you get sacked, which is bollocks because it's like sport is different. Like, sport is so much more public and it's like performance.
Yeah,
it's really high level performance in which everything is kind of everything is at stake all the time because you're playing a game against other people who are trying to beat you. It's not like being a journalist who misses a story profession who gets something wrong.
There is no equivalent.
There is
industry.
No equivalent.
Yeah, yeah. Like, there's no mistake, really, that any of you guys could make that would be an immediate sacking. Like, it would have to be...
It's not like missing a Tottenham contract.
No, it would have to be something that's, like, done with malicious intent, essentially, for me to dismiss you, like, offhand, like, with one thing. Like, there's even, like, if you make an honest mistake like he did,
yeah,
that like causes some legal bother, I guess,
mm,
like it's still not, you're still not going to get sacked for it,
yeah, yeah,
because it's not something that's done with in maliciously or with intent, like so. I kind of agree the same for Karius, like if he'd thrown them into his net deliberately,
mm,
then yeah, obviously he would be sacked and he'd probably be in jail, but he, it wasn't, so Liverpool aren't going to like terminate his contract,
yeah,
like it's absolutely unrealistic. And again, it's just, you know what it is, it's just a reminder that you can't compare these things with normal jobs, no, because they're completely different worlds. Mm. And look, I feel dreadfully sorry for Loris Karius. And I say, if I was a kind of a German team below like Bayern Munich, I'd probably think you could get him cheap now.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's a good young German goalkeeper. Might as well give it a go. Thing is, they've got loads of good young German goalkeepers already. Bernd Leno, probably gonna, I think he's on Arsenal's radar for this season. Mm. And Leverkusen looking to sell him. They've signed the Eintracht Frankfurt goalkeeper, who again is another young talented goalkeeper. So that's probably what I'd do if I was a German club trying to. But you know, he's going to have that smell, especially in the Premier League. Like that stink is on Karius,
yeah,
until he proves otherwise. So Liverpool might, it might have cost Liverpool a lot of money. Basically, that, those mistakes, they might have to go out and spend a lot on a good goalkeeper, which doesn't come cheap. Because if you want to buy Jan Oblak, you know the price already and his release clause.
Million?
It's, yeah, like 75, 80 million. If you want to buy Alisson, it's going to be about 60 million, and Real Madrid are interested as well. So these things aren't easy.
Mm-hmm. Is Alisson good?
Yeah, although he had a bad game.
I've not really seen much of
him. I can't say to have seen him super regularly, but very highly rated.
Do you think he's better than Edison?
No, Edison is probably one of the best goalkeepers in the world, I think. Mm. What about Jack Butland? I mean, like Liverpool, even then, could be fighting in the 25, 30 million bracket. Is it
good,
worth it?
There'll be good bidders for Butland as well this summer, won't there? West Ham, Newcastle.
Maybe, yeah, in that ballpark of what, 20 million, do you think? I don't know. The thing about Butland is he hasn't necessarily like strung a lot of good performances together in a while, which would be a concern for me. You know, it's fine to buy players from relegated teams who aren't necessarily in form, but quite a lot of the times it's kind of the better players from the relegated teams. Whereas what has Butland done that's really made him stand out in recent 12 to 18 months? I don't know. Anything else people like to bring up from the Champions League final?
No.
Or going forward out of the Champions League final?
No.
Real's legacy, we've already talked about it, I suppose. And
you've written about it extensively. Yeah. I mean, there is, by the way, a load of stuff on independent.co.uk/football. An incredibly good weekend in terms of lots of you have read a lot of this stuff already.
Can I, if you haven't yet, please read Jonathan Liu's live piece from the game on Saturday.
If you Google,
I don't know when he will have filed it. Like an hour after, yeah, half
less,
an hour after, yeah,
much
kickoff?
Less, much less. It was about 10 minutes after kickoff.
I mean, I'm kind of biased because he's one of my best friends.
Sorry, final whistle.
But it's one of the best live pieces written from a sporting event I've ever read. It's the kind of thing that a normal person, or not, I mean, a normal person can dream of doing it. But like, you know, you wouldn't be surprised if you read it and then someone said, oh yeah, he spent 4 days after the final working on it. It's really, so, so, so good. Please, please go and read it.
What
if you
really stood
already.
Out for me about Johnny's piece in that regard was actually how much he nailed the atmosphere at a game as big as that. Like, just what it feels like beforehand.
That's ultimately the most impressive thing about it is, I remember talking to Tony Evans, former football editor of the Times a while ago about stuff like this. And he said, you know, the hardest thing and the best thing that a writer can do is if they can capture the whole mood of everything and the entire match they've saw and file that pretty much on the whistle.
Yeah.
That is an incredible talent.
Yeah.
And this came minutes after the final whistle. Now, and we were super busy in here and like everyone was like all hands to the pump, whatever. And I didn't really get to read his piece until actually the morning after.
Yeah, same here,
one of the other guys was dealing with Johnny's piece. And it was so extraordinary how everything we've just spent 45 minutes talking about here and trying to condense all these huge storylines into one thing and the meaning of everything that happened and how it felt for Liverpool to be heartbroken like that and how it felt for Madrid to be tasting glory again and Salah and Ramos and Bale and Ronaldo, all of these things captured unbelievably well in one piece.
Yeah.
Like pretty much as soon as it finishes.
Yeah.
Extraordinary accomplishment to do that.
Yeah, I thought Jack was actually going to recommend his Steve Bruce quotes piece.
Well, that's amazing. If you really want to understand the second best piece of football journalism written over the weekend, and this would probably be borne out by the traffic numbers if you check.
Yeah.
When I wrote about how Steve Bruce said he was disappointed.
He was disappointed, was he?
Yeah.
Bombshell.
After Aston Villa lost.
A surprising twist.
So yeah, if you independent.co.uk, you can probably still find it. If not, I will be tweeting.
There's loads of good stuff on there. If you haven't read it already, then do make a beeline for Johnny's piece. I guess if you Google Liverpool emptiness, Jonathan Liu, independent, you will find it. It'll probably be the top result. So go and find that. Before we do go, there's no other football to preview really.
England Nigeria on Saturday.
England Nigeria on Saturday. England stuff. Like, I think we'll really deal with the World Cup a bit closer to the tournament.
But what's interesting now is a classic piece of World Cup build up, in the sense of suddenly
build them up to knock them down.
Build them up to knock them down. But it actually goes beyond that with this whole Raheem Sterling.
Yeah, it's worse than that.
Let's talk Raheem Sterling. So, Jack, do you want to introduce what's happened today?
So, the front page of The Sun this morning is a picture of Raheem Sterling's, of a tattoo which Raheem Sterling has on his leg of a machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the front page is obviously very negative. It says that he shouldn't have had this tattoo. There are critical quotes within the piece. Mm. Raheem Sterling this morning went on Instagram and said that he is very much anti-gun, that his father was shot to death when he was 2 years old, and he would never touch a gun in his life. And it's a very personal tattoo for Sterling to have. I mean, my own view is that this is, like, lots of people have been saying this, say, typical World Cup build up,
yeah,
you know. It's worse than that. It is, like, the fact is that over the last few years there has been a campaign against Sterling from, you know, parts of the right wing press, mainly The Sun, but not exclusively them, which has basically been to say to Sterling, you are not one of us.
Know your place.
Yeah, we don't like you, we don't approve of you. You might well play for Liverpool or Manchester City in England, but we don't see you as one of us. We see you as other. And everything that you do, whether it's shopping in Poundland or buying your mum a nice house.
He's actually been criticised both for
being
spending
lavish
his money
and being not lavish enough.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Everything you do is going to be seen through this prism. And this prism is, you know, I mean, it is his blackness. Like, that is what, I mean, that is the issue. You know, going diving.
Mm.
Leaving Liverpool, like, everything he does is seen in this way. It's completely disgusting. It's so obvious for what it is, and it's not the same. You know, it's not the same as tabloids digging out an England player,
yeah,
because it's the same player over and over and over and over again. Whatever he chooses to do, I don't really know what else to say. Like, I don't know what this is. There a
but
solution?
The one thing I think it's actually just because of the nature of the two in and out, like. Objectively, take away all the other Sterling stuff, but it is probably fair to ask why a player has a tattoo of an assault weapon. But ask the question, right? Rather than putting it on a front page.
Yeah, I mean, I look forward to the Sun's detailed analysis of the tattoos of all the other players in the Premier League. I'm sure if you looked at them, there's a lot of very tasteless tattoos. I mean, I saw on Twitter earlier, like, other players in the Premier League with gun tattoos.
Mm.
So there's tons of them. A lot of them are white players, but
That's with David Beckham, right? So that was the last player I can remember us getting, like, a running commentary of every tattoo he had. And basically, the thing with David Beckham is, you know, he was a working class boy from Leytonstone, and he worked his way up to the top, and he became, at one point, the most famous person in England and from England, I guess, outside the Queen at one period, and went on to immense success and wealth, and went to Real Madrid, PSG, Milan, wherever, and retired. But that's, like, the sort of working class person that the right wing press will allow, because it's a hard working son of a plumber or whatever who's worked their way up to the top. The type of working class person they don't like, and they certainly don't want moving up the social strata, because it might cost the people that read that paper, is people like Raheem Sterling, who, in many ways, I mean, Raheem Sterling in his career might make more money from football than David Beckham ever did, because of the time difference. Now, David obviously has got a lot of money on the side from different things, not least an incredibly successful wife. But people like Raheem Sterling, who are Raheem, I believe, is a descendant of Caribbean immigrants, you know, and I think
he was born in Jamaica.
Yeah, so we've seen how Caribbean immigrants and the descendants of Caribbean immigrants have been treated recently with the Windrush stuff, and it is like, oh, you're okay to be part of our society on our terms.
Yeah, I mean, I remember Sterling's often compared to John Barnes, another England player from Jamaica, and we were talking the other week about this on this podcast, that when, I think it was when Barnes scored in the Maracanã, and on the flight back, some England...
Oh, yeah, it's in Tony Evans' book. Yeah,
some England... That's it, it's in Tony Evans' excellent new book. Some England skinhead said to him, oh, you know...
They knew he was in earshot, and they said stuff like, it's only 1-0 because it doesn't count when one of them scored. Well, they used worse terms than one of them.
Yeah, I mean, like, how actually different is the treatment of Sterling today? It's basically saying you may well play for England, but we don't really accept you in doing that. We don't really embrace you and your rights to be part of this team.
But this is literally the other side of it. I mean, and it's not a particularly revelatory point, but there's clearly an audience for these stories because obviously they get so much criticism every time they do one now, but on the other side, they keep on doing them because there's, you know, a certain number of people obviously seem to engage with it.
In that case, how much... I mean, I'm sure that is right, but I wondered, like, to what extent are those opinions formed by...
Yeah, that's true as well.
Formed by the tabloids? Rather than, like, I think there's evidence, I mean, I don't know the studies offhand, that, like, you know, the media doesn't just respond to preferences, it forms as well.
Of course.
I think the problem is, so, like, Piers Morgan, who's an outspoken supporter of gun control, I guess, as well as many other things, and he's come out and said, like, you know, why should he have a gun tattooed on him? That's absolutely ridiculous. I'm sure, you know, and what he does very well, Morgan, as we know, was a very successful tabloid editor. And what he does now is goes on Twitter, says something to get a reaction, gets a big reaction. They talk about it on his TV show, Good Morning Britain. He comes off air, writes a Mail Online column about the whole thing. And every day he creates this huge content loop of controversy around him, which essentially keeps him in work. He's very successful at doing it. If you contribute to that, maybe next time think about contributing to that. But, you know, he said today, like, why does it have to be a gun? Like, it's a gun problem. It's like, you support Arsenal, a club which on the badge, there is a large artillery weapon, which is made for designed for killing tens or hundreds of people. So if there's a real issue here, then I'd say get the artillery off that, because, you know, that could mow down a lot
more
people.
Change the name of Arsenal.
Since when were people's tattoos accountable to Piers Morgan?
Yeah.
The idea that you have to, like, justify it to some guy on TV or to the newspaper.
And linking it to one of his more admirable pet projects, I suppose, or pet subjects, but it's still a subject in a different country. Of American gun control.
I mean, it's about the only thing I agree with Morgan on. It is his stance on gun control. I thought when he was at CNN, he was very brave to take a huge stance on it. But
it's kind of irrelevant to this.
And also, like, you know, the problem with him, as we've seen before, is like people like David Beckham, who never had any time for him and completely brushed him aside. The petty vendetta he carries out against the Beckhams at every opportunity is the most pathetic thing you've ever seen. So, you know, we know it's just a controversy vehicle to ride on. So we know that's what it is. And obviously people like, you know, The Sun are seeing this as a controversy vehicle and all these things. The bad thing for me is it really, like, whenever we cover England, right, and we cover England like in the way we cover any other football team. Like, I never tell you guys any instructions that are any different for covering England as it would for covering Ireland or France or Spain or whatever. I just want you to go and write the piece from the game. And we get accused of all these things, like build them up to knock them down, all that sort of stuff. We'd build up England. If we think England have actually got a really good chance at the World Cup, we'd probably write that.
Yeah, yeah.
If we think they're going to be about a quarterfinal team, we're going to probably write that. If we're actually really worried and we think they're going to go out in the group stage, we'd probably write that.
Yeah.
When they go out at the end, which happens at every tournament, there's going to be some post-mortem. That isn't dwelling on the negatives. A lot of the time it's going to be looking at what's still going to be in place for the next 2 years for the Euros and then 4 years after that. And that includes, you know, players that you might want to phase out and players that you might want to phase in and stuff. That's not knocking them down. It's analysing what's occurred. And quite often with England, unfortunately, because of the track record of failure, it feels like that. But when The Sun does a front page like this, it reflects badly on everyone. And it's like it's worrying anyway because of the societal impact of what it happens if you constantly make these successful young black guys out to be villains and criminals the whole time. Yeah. But on top of that, like, it doesn't do your football coverage any good. Now, I've not talked to anyone who covers football at the Sun about this, but, you know, I wouldn't be happy if it was me. If the front page of The Independent was something like that, you know, it would affect all of our day jobs.
Yeah. Actually, the genesis of this is actually quite weird as well, if you think about it, in terms of the interest. Because some of these certain perceptions of Sterling arose, first of all, I suppose...
It was a Liverpool Man City move.
Yeah, the perceived greed of what...
Because he was outplaying his contract. Yeah, he was playing much better than the pay he was receiving.
Yeah, but I suppose given the history of Liverpool and the Sun, for the Sun to be the media to so hammer that view then, it's... as we discussed for the last 10 minutes, there's a lot of angles to this.
Yeah, but I think it's it is fortunately something that now like instantly is called out. Like it's not no one's in any doubt anymore. There's a lot of people who are very sharp to it,
right,
and very hot on it.
There's no benefit of the doubt left. Mm. I mean, everyone can see this for what it is.
So I was asked if we were going to write something about today, and I almost think there's no point. I almost don't want to attract attention to this. I think it will get covered over the next month or so. You know, I think if England put up Raheem Sterling to speak in Rapinoe, then it's going to come to a head, and people are going to
He's within his rights. I mean, it's not fair on the Sun journalist, and usually in a situation where certain sporting figures refuse to talk to certain media, I think there's a very in more of those situations where the journalist should kind of boycott the press conference. But in this specific case, Sterling's probably completely justified in refusing to take a question from the Sun.
Well, but the thing is more likely is he just refuses to take any question from media. Full stop. So everyone gets punished basically for what someone who works on the news desk at the Sun, has chosen to do. And you know, obviously, we're questioning why they've chosen to do it anyway. So it's a very unsavoury incident, but unfortunately, it's just the latest chapter in a catalogue of incidents that we'd rather not talk about, but I think it's just something that today we have to address. If it was a quieter news week, we probably wouldn't even talk about it. But otherwise, I think that's pretty much all there is to say on it. But thank you, Miguel, for all of your hard work this season, and also obviously in Kiev with all the guys. I trust you kept them on the straight and narrow.
Big time.
At your late dinner. Jack, the Championship Player Final, thank you for that. A lot more Fulham for you next season, I guess. For all of us, I mean, it's the most local team to the office now, so that's helpful. Thank you for everything. We all be following England, of course, in the World Cup.
Some of the time.
So much good content to come from that stuff we've planned for 1 week out, 2 weeks out. The first round of group games, you've got a gazillion great features to come, so stay tuned for that. I also should say we're going to have a World Cup Daily Bulletin newsletter that'll get you in your inbox at 7 a.m. every day, so you can read the latest kind of roundup from the night before and a preview of what's to come. To sign up for that, you'll have to see that on our website. There'll be a little sign up box. Just enter in your email address, bish bash bosh, you're done. Make sure you do that. We'll be tweeting that out as well, if that's where you prefer to keep in touch. And also we'll have podcasts. I hope, and I'm ready to confirm this very soon, I hope we're going to have a podcast every single day for you to listen to in the morning. So if you're excited about that, then as ever, please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. And I guess for the final time in the 2017-18 season, I say thank you to Jack Pitbrook.
You're welcome.
I say thank you to Miguel Delaney.
Thank you.
And thank you most of all to the listeners and Matt Murphy, the podcast producer, who's done a great job this season, for all of your help. Thank you and goodbye.